Hey folks, this is the Contextual Insurgent Podcast, and I'm your host, Aaron Smith. I'm an activist, an analyst, a writer, and a sensemaker. I'm a Republican, a former SFGOP Central Committee Delegate, where I was the Deputy Vice Chair of Communications. As California GOP-endorsed State Senate candidate, where I managed to win 11% of the vote in San Francisco, which, trust me, is better than average. I've also been involved with the firearms community and Second Amendment rights. I was on the cover of Time magazine in November of 2018 for their Guns in America issue. But I'm probably best known for my free speech activism and facing off with hard lefties like Antifa in California and the Pacific Northwest since 2017. The general topic of this podcast series will be politics in the current culture war, as seen from my unique, rather hands-on experience and knowledge, but also intend to include a practical element focused on giving you the conceptual tools to build towards true grassroots, nonviolent political change. You may have noticed lefties usually seem to get what they want regardless of how elections go, and I want to help you change that. You can also sign up for my Substack newsletter at contextualinsurgent.substack.com. I have a weekly newsletter that looks back at some of the highlighted stories of the week and gives you some feedback and analysis of what's happening. If you'd like to support my work, I have a Patreon at patreon.com/EESmith4. That's the number 4. I also have a Cash App at $EESmith4. Again, that's the number 4. For the cost of a mocha frappuccino once a month, you can support my work, which is ultimately about helping you. Hey everyone, welcome back to my podcast. This is Season 2, Episode 4 of the Contextual Insurgent Project. This is the series where I focus on specific incidents in history and try to analyze and suss out some lessons for you that we can apply today for activism and organizing. Today I'm actually going to compare and contrast two different incidents. I'm going to talk about the Battle of Athens, which happened in Athens, Tennessee in 1946, and the Battle of Blair Mountain, which happened in 1921, about 300 miles to the north in Logan County, West Virginia. I think these are really interesting incidents to compare and contrast. They're both armed uprisings against local government. They both happened in Appalachia. They were only separated by 25 years and 300 miles. But one was a success and one was a huge failure. I have right and left-leaning people that listen to this podcast. Something I found that's interesting is, if you're a right-leaning person, especially a gun person, I can pretty much guarantee you've heard about the Battle of Athens. I mean, it's pretty famous. It was also in the novel Unintended Consequences about John Ross, who, like two-thirds of the book, was about, you know, the history of the gun culture. I mean, it's very much a touchstone in gun culture, talking about, you know, the Second Amendment is to fight against tyranny, and the Battle of Athens is the incident people usually trot out, you know, after, like, maybe the Revolutionary War, is the Battle of Athens in, like, modern times. It's like, yes, you can use guns to fight tyranny. On the other hand, very few people have heard of the Battle of Blair Mountain. If you're a lefty, you probably have heard of the Battle of Blair Mountain. You may not know about the Battle of Athens, though. It's really very interesting. I think it's a waste because the two incidents are so educational to compare. For starters, I'm going to go over both of these incidents. We're going to start with the Battle of Athens, and we'll talk about the Battle of Blair Mountain. I want to make sure everyone kind of has a basic understanding of what went on. And then once I'm done with that, we'll actually dive into these two incidents and see what worked, what went wrong, what they could have done better, and what lessons you need to take away from it. The Battle of Athens was ultimately about police brutality, political corruption, and voter intimidation and voter fraud. It happened in McMinn County, Tennessee, which is in eastern Tennessee. Now, you have to understand that in the 1930s and 1940s in Tennessee, most of the state was under the control of a man named Edward Crump. Boss Crump, as he was known, was based in Memphis. And in 1936, his machine took control of McMinn County when their candidate Paul Cantrell was elected sheriff. In those days, the sheriff and the local police didn't actually get paid salaries. They got paid fees for every person they arrested and whatever they charged for. So, if you can imagine, there was something called fee grabbing, which was they would arrest tourists and travelers and people passing through, and it was essentially, like, literally a highway robbery under color of law. From what I understand, Cantrell was actually not that bad. Yeah, he was corrupt, and he engaged in the fee grabbing, but he wasn't too brutal. But then in 1942, he decided to run for state senate and had his deputy Pat Mansfield elected sheriff for those years. Mansfield was not so benign. Basically, it was super corrupt. I mean, Mansfield ran everything. He ran all the businesses around there. At least they had to follow his orders. They also had pressure on the newspapers and schools. I mean, if you crossed the wrong person, you were essentially shut out of public life. It's very much the same dynamic I talked about in the Rosa Parks episode, where Rosa was terrified she'd be fired if they knew she went to the Highlander Center. And Septima Clark, who was one of the teachers of the Highlander Center, actually lost her job and her pension because they found out she was trying to teach and organize in her area. This type of corruption also extended to the state level, and Boss Crump would essentially handpick the people he wanted to be the state's governing elected officials. For example, in 1946, when the Battle of Athens actually happened, the governor of Tennessee was a man named Jim Nance McCord, who was one of Crump's cronies. Of course, it's 1940s, so World War II is happening. Lots of young men are off overseas fighting for America, and in the case of McMinn County, around 10% of their population, around 3,000 young men, are overseas serving in the armed forces. And this fee grabbing was even applied to them when they came home on leave. In fact, two GIs were shot and killed during fee grabbing attempts. When word of this made it back overseas to the other GIs, the other young men of McMinn County, they were extremely angry and they were ready to come home and do something about it. So the war's over. These young men get mustered out and sent home. And of course they have their built up pay that they've saved while they were overseas fighting when they couldn't spend it. So the cops go wild and they're basically essentially trying to rob all these GIs. Of course that made them even more aggravated and ready to start changing things. So they actually start a nonpartisan group called the GI Nonpartisan League and had a meeting where they selected a nonpartisan slate of candidates. They selected five candidates, and they tried to match the electoral demographics of the county, so they ended up coming with three Republicans and two Democrats. The slogan for the GI's part nonpartisan group was, "Your vote will be counted as cast." And they selected a man named Knox Henry to run as sheriff in opposition to Cantrell. You see, Mansfield had been sheriff for 4 years, and he was running for state senate, the state senate seat that Cantrell had been holding, and Cantrell was running for sheriff again. So they were kind of switching back and forth, and the historical analysis of this is they were just trying to spread the graft around. The league actually raised a good bit of fundraising from a lot of local people and businesses, but they were still worried that the local machine would rig the election, and they were also worried about what essentially the criminal deputies and law enforcement and other crooked machine supporters would do. So they also created a self-defense force. A guy named Bill White handpicked a bunch of frontline GI vets, people that had actually been in combat and had pretty steady spirits, but also were willing to fight if needed. Things are really tense now, so the local machine's also hiring a bunch of deputies from other counties and even out of other states to come in and work, and they were paying them the equivalent of $650 a day in 1946 to come support them during the election. So the building blocks were there for a conflict. You know, things are incredibly tense and both sides are arming up and organizing. So election day happens and things continue to escalate. Poll watchers were assaulted and beaten for things like asking to open the ballot box and certify it as empty. You know, that guy was arrested and taken to jail. Someone else was arrested because he was protesting irregularities. And there was another incident where a guy named Wendy Wise, who was one of the patrolmen, was stopping an elderly black farmer, Tom Gillespie, from actually voting at one of the polling places. And he stopped him, and there was a poll watcher there and Gillespie both objected. He's like, "Hey, why won't you let me vote?" Wendy Wise actually punched Gillespie in the face with brass knuckles. Then Gillespie tried to run away, and Windy then pulled his pistol and shot him in the back. By this point, the GIs were arming themselves, and while the historical record's kind of blurry, we do know that at least 3 ballot boxes ended up at the jail, and 7 deputies were taken hostage by the GIs, who took them out in the woods and tied them to a tree and beat the hell out of them. Of course, everyone's pissed off at everyone else at this point. After the polls close and the counting starts, the GIs are ahead 3-1. The problem is, they've got 3 ballot boxes in the local jail with the people in there that are a majority of the election commission that can certify the vote for the county. There's nothing stopping them at this point from stuffing the ballot boxes of whatever votes they need to win, then rubber stamping the results and declaring themselves the winner. The GIs had already sent a message to the governor and the U.S. Attorney General about what was going on, and they were asking for help, and they didn't hear anything back, so they pretty much knew they were on their own. It's around 9 p.m. at this point, so the GIs raid the National Guard Armory, and everybody who doesn't have a gun, they end up giving them guns, and it's several hundred people besieging the jail at this point, and there's at least probably 50 to 100 people in the jail. So you've got several hundred people engaging in a gun battle in the middle of Athens, Tennessee, and they even bring up dynamite and they start blowing up the cars out front of the jail. And eventually they're setting off dynamite next to the walls. And again, the accounts are kind of blurry, but it seems that they blew the door off, and the sheriff surrendered the ballot boxes, and they brought everyone out in front, right in front of everyone in the middle of the street, went through the ballot boxes, counted them in front of everyone. The GI slate ended up winning roughly 2-1. The election got certified. No one got killed. The only person who went to jail was Windy Wise for shooting Tom Gillespie in the back. He spent somewhere like 3 years in prison for that. And ever since, the Battle of Athens has been one of the most celebrated incidents in the American gun culture. That was the victory. Let's talk about the defeat, the Battle of Blair Mountain. The Battle of Blair Mountain has always been incredibly fascinating to me because most people have hardly heard of it, but it was the largest armed uprising in America since the Civil War. Blair Mountain also marked the end of the West Virginia Coal Wars, which was the name for about a decade's worth of conflict between miners in West Virginia attempting to unionize and the companies that they worked for. These companies would hire people like the Baldwin Felt Agency, which was a private detective agency that was essentially a private army at the time. And within that decade, there was multiple shootouts and targeted assassinations. This was not just a minor skirmish. This was some pretty serious bad blood being built up over a decade or so. See, the miners then lived in something called a company town, which was what it sounded like. The company owned the whole town. They owned all the houses. They were essentially not only their employer, but also their landlord. They owned the stores. That's where they used to have companies script, and there were things where, I mean, of course, this is back when you could immediately be fired if you tried to join a union. There were some of the contracts that required people to buy stuff from company stores, and they would trade in script. So it almost became like something like indentured servitude. So, and also because they lived in these homes that were owned by the company, if they tried to unionize, they were fired and immediately evicted. And the people that evicted them were agents from the Baldwin Felts Company. I've talked before in the past, especially like in the Rosa Parks episode, about how socialists and anarchists used to do a lot of activism and organizing in rural areas, and this is a great example of this. When the strikes first started in 1912 in West Virginia, they had a lot of conflict with the Baldwin Felts agency, who were sending the agents to evict people, and there were some cases where they armored a train and were driving it through the coal camps and machine gunning into tents. So the Socialist Party of America sent a shipment of machine guns and rifles and ammunition to the miners. Pretty much the whole decade was one form of conflict or another based around unionization attempts and the companies attempting to suppress it. But skip forward in our story to what's relevant to us. In 1920, there was something called the Battle of Mattawan, and it was really about a bunch of miners in Mingo County were trying to join the United Mine Workers. The company sends as usual, some Baldwin-Felts agents to evict the miners, where they get confronted by the mayor and the chief of police. The Baldwin-Felts agents tried to arrest the police chief. The police chief tried to arrest the agents. There was a shootout. A bunch of Baldwin-Felts agents got killed. After this shootout, the governor of West Virginia declared martial law in Mingo County, and they sent troops there who basically put the whole county under guard. They also tried to charge and prosecute the chief of police. His name was Sid Hatfield, and a bunch of other people that were involved. They actually tried to charge him with murdering Albert Felts, who was the brother of one of the company owner, and they were actually found not guilty. They were acquitted by a Mingo County jury. Well, they also turned around immediately after this and passed a law that said, well, you can charge these people. In criminal cases, you can charge people with jury from another county. So they did it again. They tried to charge them again for the other. There were seven agents that were killed, and they tried to charge them again for the other six agents that were killed. Well, when Hatfield and his deputy show up for their second trial, they get ambushed by Baldwin-Felts agents and gunned down on the steps of the courthouse. Now, of course, being legal proceedings, it takes a little while for that. And them being gunned down happened a year later, August 1st, 1921. It had not been a peaceful year. There had been a bunch of skirmishes and conflicts between miners and government/company forces over that time period. But them killing the chief of police and his deputy really just tipped the pot over at that point. In response to these murders, the local miner union called for a rally in the state capitol in Charleston, West Virginia for August 7th, 1921. They presented Governor Morgan with a list of demands that included, among other things, ending martial law in the county. The governor rejected all of these demands. The miners decided they would do it themselves. So they began to assemble at Lynn's Creek Mountain, just south of Charleston, on August 20th. Within 4 days, they had almost 15,000 men, and then began to march south to Mingo County, which was 80 miles away. Their objectives were to end martial law in the county, free the miners who had been arrested under martial law, and organize a union in the county. Unfortunately for the miners, the coal companies had taken advantage of the delay to beef up their own defenses. The sheriff of Logan County, Don Chafin, was fiercely anti-union and ended up raising his own private army of around 2,000 armed men. The sheriff dug his forces in along the border of Logan County to act as a blocking force, choosing the high ground around Blair Mountain as a defensive position. The fighting started August 25th when the miners reached the border of Logan County, and over the following days, as more miners reached that location, the fighting intensified. President Harding actually threatened to send in federal troops as well as the Army Air Corps bombers and bomb the miners. The Army Air Corps ended up not bombing the miners, but they did fly surveillance flights, and there were private airplanes that were hired to drop bombs on the miners. It's estimated that around 20,000 men were engaged in combat, over a million rounds were fired, and the fighting took place along a 20-mile front. The fighting went on for about a week. The miners were unable to reach their objectives, and the fighting really tapered off around September 2nd when federal troops were sent in. Apparently, a lot of the miners were veterans, and they didn't want to shoot at U.S. troops. They were happy to shoot at the Baldwin-Felts crowd, but they weren't actually willing to shoot at soldiers. So to sum it up, they really didn't accomplish anything. The miners didn't reach their objective. They didn't accomplish any of their goals. They almost had 1,000 miners arrested for various crimes, murder, conspiracy, accessory treason. Some of them were acquitted, but then some were convicted. And it says the last one was paroled in 1925, so some of the guys did 4 years in prison for that. The union basically got crushed, lost most of its membership, and it didn't actually recover until Roosevelt was in office and he was able to really push organized labor. Okay, so that was an overview of two different armed uprisings in Appalachia. They're separated by 25 years and 300 miles. Both of them involved armed citizens facing off local government and quasi-governmental private industry. One was a success, one was a failure. Why is that? Well, Let's start with the Battle of Athens and figure out why that was a victory. Well, for starters, they had a fairly simple objective. There was 3 ballot boxes in the jail. They needed to retrieve those ballot boxes and count them. They had already counted all the other ballots. That was the last stepping stone to certifying the election and their victory. The GIs also outnumbered and surrounded their opponents. The sheriff and his deputies, usually estimated around 50 to 60 of them at this point, were inside the jail. And the GIs, the numbers are anywhere from 200 to 300 at the low end to up to 2,000 according to some estimates. Everyone knew that Election Day was going to be contentious, but no one had really expected it to escalate to this point either, where the local government is being besieged in the local jail by the GI Nonpartisan League and their allies. So no one had known to prep for sending reinforcements, and at this point it's late at night, and it's going to be several hours and probably mid-morning at the earliest in the following day before anyone could arrive. The GIs were combat veterans, for many of them, and they were also men who, being from the same rural county, if they didn't know each other, they at least knew of each other, knew each other by reputation, and their experiences had formed the basis for what they could build into something you would consider an affinity group, which is kind of what the GI Nonpartisan League was. In fact, at their meetings, you had to show a veteran's ID to enter. The GIs, because of their smaller numbers and the fact they already had an organization and leadership they had built before that day, were able to adapt to the situation as it evolved and were able to control their responses in a way that the miners at Blair Mountain simply were not able to. Another critical factor is the fact no one died. Multiple people were injured, but no one actually passed away. And the fact that the GIs were able to finish and certify the election and no one was killed during the process meant that by the time higher level authorities could respond, the situation had already been resolved, and there was really no sense trying to unmake what had happened. All the best decision for everyone at that point was to just shrug their shoulders and accept the results. The GIs were also in their home county. They had a broad base of support with the local population and the local businesses. So given that they had completed their objectives, they had certified the election, their nonpartisan slate had won, and no one had died, there was really not any point trying to go after them legally because they'd probably not get a conviction anyway, and this juice was simply not worth the squeeze from a political calculus standpoint. One thing that doesn't get talked a lot about in this story is the political terrain as well. See, Boss Crump was based out of Memphis, Tennessee. He was all the way on the west edge of Tennessee, almost to Arkansas. McMinn County is all the way to the east end, right at the edge of Boss Crump's territory. See, Boss Crump ran the Democratic Party, which controlled roughly 2/3 of Tennessee, and the Republican part of the state was the eastern third. McMinn County was fairly close to the border, so McMinn County was basically a fringe border county. It was not deep inside Boss Crump's territory. If you remember, Boss Crump had only controlled the county for roughly 10 years since 1936. The nonpartisan slate, in fact, as I mentioned earlier, if you remember, I mentioned that they selected 3 Republicans and 2 Democrats to match the electoral makeup of the county. There's also some interesting debate here about what was going on between the governor and Governor Jim McCord and Boss Crump. See, Governor McCord was a Crump man. He came up in the Crump machine. But I've seen some accounts that, you know, there's the historical account that most people know of that, or have heard of, that apparently the governor, when he initially went to call out the state guard, decided not to send them because he was afraid that they would join the GIs. I've also seen another account that the governor was deliberately slow-rolling, sending the National Guard, the state guard, to McKinn County, because he was trying to weaken Boss Crump. And it's sort of interesting there, you know, it's a little unclear from what I'm able to find, but it would make sense. You know, sometimes you see this a lot in a lot of these criminal organizations. A person comes up and their power grows and they start to rival the leader and they'll start to undermine them. In fact, there was a conflict between the governor and Boss Crump a year or two earlier over a sales tax, a state sales tax, and the governor actually managed to get his way. But regardless of whether or not that's true, this 1946, when the Battle of Athens happened, ended up pretty much being the high watermark of the Crump machine. Whether or not Governor McCord was playing games around the Battle of Athens in his response, he was technically aligned with the Crump machine, and 2 years later, he ended up losing the governorship to Gordon Browning, and that's really when the Crump machine began to nosedive. Crump died in 1954, and a lot of his power had essentially dissipated by that point. I think the lessons from the Battle of Athens are they really were extremely lucky. I mean, it was a perfect set of circumstances. They were facing a declining political machine, even if it wasn't yet completely evident. It was in the process of collapsing. It was about to start collapsing. They were on the fringe, kind of on the frontier of this machine. They were all the way across the state from the power center. They didn't kill anyone. They were fairly well organized people in their hometown. They also had a fairly simple and immediate objective to accomplish, and a reasonable window in which to accomplish that, and their opponents didn't have time to respond or call for reinforcements. They knew they had until sometime mid-morning of the next day to get 3 ballot boxes from the jail and count them. That was totally doable. If they had failed or lost, the consequences would have probably been horrific. A lot of people would have gone to prison. But they didn't kill anyone. They accomplished their objectives. They got the boxes out of the jail and counted them and certified the election, and their people won. There was really no point trying. There was really nothing anyone could really do realistically to overturn what happened. And the best response was really, let's just let sleeping dogs lie. That's really the most important takeaway from a Second Amendment perspective. I mean, this is a legendary incident amongst gun rights activists. I mean, there's two big points when you talk about gun rights, which is individual people protecting themselves from criminal actors, but then there's also talk of, you know, protecting yourself against tyrannical governments, or at least attempting to resist if things go really bad. We've seen in other countries they disarm the populace and genocides and everything. Even if you can't overthrow, at least you can, you know, try to take people with you, evil people with you. So there's a lot of discussions about that sort of thing, about what are the political applications of firearms if it comes to that, unfortunately. And I think that's the most important thing to take away from the Battle of Athens, is that we understand what a narrow, limited action this was and how it was a perfect set of circumstances to pull something like this off. And they really threaded the needle here. Blair Mountain, on the other hand, is basically diametrically opposite in almost all respects, and that's probably a big reason why it was a defeat. For starters, it wasn't their home county. They were from another county, and they were marching 80 miles to Mingo County, and their objective was really not very realistic. They wanted to end martial law in the county, they wanted to free all the miners that had been arrested, and they wanted to try to unionize everyone in the county that was a miner. Those are much bigger, grandiose goals than let's just get those ballot boxes out of the local jail. That's a completely different scale of things you want to accomplish. I mean, of course, and you're trying to assemble somewhere that's 80 miles away and then march. Well, it took 4 days to assemble enough people. They had like 15,000 people, and then they marched. And of course, during that time, it's going to take a while. Not everyone's marching, you know, close together. People are kind of spread out because they weren't as organized. Like, there were some leaders of the group, but they, like some of the people that were trying to unionize everyone, but they were not really down with that sort of action, and they didn't go. So it's a much more unorganized group that's traveling across like 4 counties to another county and trying to fight the police and a lot of the, like, the Baldwin Felts people, and a lot of people that have been hired from other states to come in. So the scale was radically different. Of course, when you give people 4 days warning and you let everyone know what you're going to do, well, they're going to prepare for it. So the people in Logan County, Sheriff Chafin, like, built this defensive position around Blair Mountain as like kind of a blocking force. And that's basically what happened. They were trying, the miners came in, and were trying to fight their way uphill, and they're fighting these people that are dug in defensive positions with machine guns, and then they bring in airplanes, and like there's literal, like they didn't actually use the Army Air Corps to bomb them. They just did that. They were actually talking about doing it, but they ended up not doing it. They had private planes they hired to drop, and they even dropped like poison bombs, like mustard gas and stuff. It was just, it was wild. But all that happened because they gave their opponent time to prepare. They had, you know, it was like by the time the main force got there to Logan County, it was like a week. So that's plenty of time if you're the government to get people in and move them in, start preparing and planning what you're going to do. By comparison, it was kind of an unplanned, spontaneous thing in McMinn County at Athens. It was like they took the ballot boxes in jail and they're like, okay, let's go get those ballot boxes. It's like no one really knew that was going to happen until it happened. It's like people were kind of responding to each other's actions at a local level. Totally different situation. In Blair Mountain, you had like 20,000 people engaged in like large-scale warfare, and one side even had close air support with the airplanes coming in and bombing people, and the Army Air Corps was providing surveillance flights. So that was a much, much bigger deal than what happened at Athens, and it was much harder for people to control. Once the federal troops got there, a lot of the miners just left. They weren't going to fight federal troops because a lot of them were veterans too. So they left and gave up. They ended up killing around, there was a total death toll anywhere from 100 to 200 people. Again, this is, it's a little debated on how many people died, but we do know a lot of people died. They ended up arresting like almost 1,000 miners, charging them with everything from murder to, and I covered this, but murder to treason to conspiracy. Some of them got acquitted. A bunch of them also went to jail. I think the most anyone served was like 4 years. So it wasn't like they spent 20 or 30 years in prison for it. But still, they went to jail. So to compare and contrast Blair Mountain to Athens, in Blair Mountain, they did not have a reasonable set of expectations or objectives. They didn't accomplish those objectives. They gave their enemy a lot of warning to prepare, and they killed people. Most of them also were not local to Mingo County. They were traveling. I mean, hence the whole thing that's part of giving the warning is that they were having to get people from other places to come. But still, when you're traveling 80 miles to somewhere else, you're still perceived as more of an invasion force than like a local defense situation like the Battle of Athens was. Another thing that is illustrated for me with Athens and Blair Mountain is, you know, violence is really the thing people use when they don't have nonviolent options. Ideally, you know, it's anytime you deploy violence, that's a high stakes, high investment strategy. It's, you know, there's huge losses if you lose. You know, Athens is a declining political machine, and these folks, the GIs, were trying to use just enough violence to help along the political process they were trying to work through. They reached an impasse where there was really no other option but to use violence, and then they used it. The miners, you know, they were in a much weaker position, you know, politically and economically because of the company towns and everything that was going on there in West Virginia. The businesses, you know, they're so close to the national capital and the state capital that there's a lot of influence and power that can be deployed in a short amount of time. So it was really not, you can't really apply the lessons from Athens and say, okay, cool, this works here. Guns are a freedom switch and you just deploy guns and you're free, and it doesn't work like that. You know, Blair Mountain showed very clearly that it doesn't always work. In fact, that's more the norm than the Battle of Athens. Blair Mountain also happened at the tail end of the Cold Wars. It was really kind of a culmination of the West Virginia Cold Wars. You know, you've got tons of violence and skirmishes in the previous decade, like cases where the Baldwin-Felts agency, they were like driving trains through coal camps with machine gun nests and like shooting into the tents of people, and, you know, ambushes by miners. It was pretty brutal versus, you know, Athens, where they're trying to work through it. There's at least a functional political process there. It's corrupt, but it's functional. And they're able to kind of, you know, their concerns and issues are able to be done through that political process versus where, you know, the miners in Blair Mountain, it's not so much. They have, you know, Baldwin Felt's agents that are actually assassinating the chief of police. Now, I ran through these two incidents and I gave you some lessons from more of the tactical and operational level. Now I want to step back and give you the big takeaway lesson. So I talked about these two incidents and I gave you some lessons from each one and more of the tactical and operational level. But now I want to break it down to you and give you the one big important takeaway lesson. If you're someone who has a complaint or concern with the way your society is run at the local, state, or federal level, and you don't feel like voting will fix it, and you're trying to vote and you're not getting what you want, learn about the array of options between voting and shooting. And this is one of the biggest blind spots I've seen on the right, and I've harped on this a lot in this podcast, is there's a broad array of political options or even nonviolent change for your society between voting and shooting. Even if you win an election, voting itself is not enough. Voting is just step one. This was actually something that backfired on the GIs after the Battle of Athens. They elected their slate, but then within a couple of years, many of them were complaining. It's like, we've elected just another machine that's just as corrupt as the one we kicked out. That's because they voted, they won. And I mean, granted, at the end, they had to go do some shooting too, but still, it's like they voted and they had to do a little shooting and then they went back to their lives and they're like, why the hell is everything going back the way it was? That's because you have to stay engaged. You have to learn about your local government and start figuring out, you know, I've talked about a lot of this in this podcast. You know, I talked about the area studies in season 2, episode 1, like how to do a power structure analysis. You have to keep building structures. You have to keep building you have to keep building networks. You have to keep pressuring the people. Once they get into office, you elect someone in office, you can't just turn your back on them. You have to keep pressuring them. Not only, like, the left builds pressure campaigns and they pressure politicians, and they pressure our politicians too, but they pressure their politicians to hold them to what they promised to do. That keeps them from drifting away from them politically. But another thing it does is it gives them political cover to do what they promise to do. So, like, if I promise to do something for you and you don't publicly pressure me after you help get me elected, then it's easy for me to turn my back on you. But if you keep pressuring me publicly, even if I intended to always keep my promise to you, it makes it easier for me as a politician to go, yeah, hey, I've got to do this. Sorry, these people over here are pressuring me. I've got to, you know, I'm under so much pressure. I have no choice but to continue to go ahead with this. Even if I intended to do it all along, I can say that to other people who want me to do something else. So that's kind of how that works. It's like, you can pressure other politicians, but then you can pressure your politicians and you're giving them political cover. You know, it's that FDR quote, you know, after FDR was elected in 1933, he had some union people come visit him and propose something that later became the New Deal. And he's like, gentlemen, you've convinced me. Now I want you to go out there and make me do it. And that's what he was asking for. He's like, pressure me to do what you want me to do. And that gives me the cover to complete our objectives. If you're someone who's an elite, which probably not listening to my podcast, but in case you are, you want to give people who disagree with you a way to press for change that does not involve violence. Violence ultimately is what happens when people feel like they do not have any peaceful options to push or advocate for their interests. I mean, this is what we saw happen at in the Cold Wars, the West Virginia Cold Wars. It's like these miners are living in company towns. The company that they work for also owns their home. And if they quit or get fired, they're evicted within a couple of days and they're homeless. So there's a tremendous, and they had to buy, a lot of them had to buy from company stores using scripts. So they're this very feudalistic existence. You know, there's not, even when they're voting for people, like the chief of police, the companies have so much power, they're able to really ignore or override the local governments. So it did become a situation where a lot of these miners felt like they had no option. So there is a bit of blame for that when you do not leave enough options for people to to press for their interests that are, you know, peaceful ways to do it, peaceful avenues to protect themselves, they're going to turn to violence out of desperation. And that's sort of what concerns me about what's happening in this country right now, is we've seen this growing tension. Like it or not, there are a lot of legitimate grievances for people. And they're trying to work, like a lot of your flyover country Americans and red state people have a lot of legitimate grievances about the direction the country's going in, about how it's undermining their interests. We saw this with the Tea Party, you know, that was the first manifestation of that. Trump got elected in 2016 by running on that, you know, immigration, trade, and war. And now we're seeing it now where they're like trying to completely like erase Trump. They're trying to make sure he can never run for president again. They're talking about trying to expel Congress people. Yeah, I think Taylor Greene's a little kooky, but she's like a wine-aren't kooky. And like it or not, she is someone who's elected by people in Georgia to represent them. So trying to expel her and trying to target, you know, millions of Trump voters who have legitimate grievances and kick them out of the political process, that is scary and concerning for me. I mean, that's going to force people where they feel like they have no other choice but using violence. And part of the problem for that is, and this is something I've talked about a lot on this podcast, and the reason I started this podcast is I'm trying to help people learn and about the options that are between that voting and shooting. Like, what are the nonviolent options? Unfortunately, you know, like the left is so much better at understanding, you know, that spectrum of choices between shooting and voting. You know, they have all their interest groups that are able to do pressure campaigns and all these other things, and all this types of grassroots mutual aid activism, all these interesting networks of things they can use to kind of work up and down, like on that spectrum of force and spectrum of persuasion. And the right doesn't really have that. And I feel like if we're closing off, you know, if the voting and petition of grievances type stuff is being closed off, it's pushing people towards, they only feel like there's still violence. And I want to try to give people other options. So thanks for joining me. I hope you found this podcast episode useful and insightful and illuminating. If you agree, especially if you disagree, please let me know. Send me an email. And you can be sure to follow me at contextualinsurgent.substack.com. That's where I do my newsletter. And I'm going to be sending out one later today on my weekly roundup. So be sure to sign up for that. Anyway, folks, thanks. This has been Aaron Smith with the Contextual Insurgent Podcast.